You're listening to Productive Flourishing. Thanks for joining us today.
And I think many people get very agitated when you start saying, if they have no interest in it, why should you force them? Some of this is just wishful thinking and says it's all the fault of the teacher. Like, if you had just been a good teacher, 100% of kids would have found it fascinating. And it's just like, well, find me a human being that good. One. And I will kneel down before you in amazement. There just is not such, there is no such thing. There isn't any philosophy professor so good that 100% of randomly selected college kids will find it fascinating. Like, if attendance is optional, a lot of them won't even bother to show up. You know, I have this quote from Steven Pinker in the book, where again, you know, he says, "Look, I'm routinely voted one of the best teachers at Harvard, and yet in the middle of the semester, half my students aren't there. So what does this tell me?" So you know, like. The best students in the world find one of the best teachers in the world boring. Like, what more can you say?
That was Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University, blogger for EconLog, and author of The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. He joins me today for a vibrant discussion about why education is a waste of time and money, but why we still buy it. We also discuss the degree to which non-rational motivations, which we sometimes call reasons, can affect larger macro trends. The more non-rational motivations anchor behavior, the less it matters that what we're doing is unreasonable. If you like this episode, you may also like episode 169 with Penelope Trunk and episode 153 with Michelle Jones. I'm Charlie Gilkey, and this is Productive Flourishing. Welcome to Productive Flourishing, where we explore how to do the work that matters so you become your best self in the world. I'm your host, Charlie Gilkey, and I'm joined by Angela Wheeler and other guests who will share their stories, insights, wins, and challenges in the hopes that our journeys and stories will help you with yours. Now, on to the show. If you ask me to name the single biggest workplace time waster, I don't even have to think about it. The answer is email. In fact, a recent study found that almost 50% of the time that managers spend tending to their inboxes is spent on emails that should have never been sent to them or that didn't really need an answer in the first place. But what if you could just press a magic button and never see those time-wasting emails again? Well, that's exactly what SaneBox does. With just a few clicks, SaneBox automatically gets your email under control and filters out the messages that don't need your focus. And you don't even have to switch email apps, because it works in concert with whichever email clients you already use. It also has some nifty features like the Sane Black Hole, where you can vanquish senders you never want to hear from again, and Sane Reminders for sending email reminders to your future self. See how SaneBox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit SaneBox.com/giant today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. That's SaneBox.com/giant. I've used and loved SaneBox for years, and I think you will too. Brian, thanks so much for joining me. We're both passionate about education and especially alternative education models because, well, the system is broken in so many different ways. And so I'm so happy to have come across your book and be introduced to you through Todd Cashton. And so thanks for your work and thanks for showing up on the show today.
Great pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot.
Alrighty. So your book is The Case Against Education. And as you mentioned in your book, you're now in your 41st grade, but it might be 42nd grade now, right?
Yeah, now it's 42nd.
42nd. Yeah. And the academic institution has treated you really, really well. Like, you're not one of those, like, you know, struggling professors that can't get tenure or, you know, everybody hates on you. But so why write a book that is actually makes a case against education, against the very thing that works so well for you?
Yeah, so I see myself as a whistleblower. If I, you know, like, you know, I've just seen so much waste of time and money over all these decades in education, and I feel like as an insider, I'm in a unique position to credibly complain. So, you know, like again, like you were saying, if I were someone who had just failed to get tenure and I was living in my mom's basement, then people would say, yeah, this guy's got sour grapes. Of course, he's going to be unhappy with the system. But you know, the system's fantastic for me. It gives me a dream job for life. Everything's great. But yet from the age of 5 on, I've just seen a system that seems dysfunctional to me. And on top of it, there's also just a great intellectual puzzle to me. Like, what in the world is going on? Why is it so dysfunctional? It seems, you know, for most things, there's pressure that would go and at least move things in a better direction. And education seems to be so stagnant.
so stagnant. And, you know, there are different ways, and you talk about this in your book, there are different ways we might critique education as it is right now, right? We can critique the sort of from a pedagogical practice, like how are we teaching, whether that actually is you know, in a way that students actually learn, or whether it benefits the professors and the teachers doing the teachings. Like, that's one sort of argument. Mm-hmm. I think, but your argument is different, right? Your argument you know, that, well, tell us what your argument is so that I don't completely butcher it.
Yeah. So the heart of it just says that most of what kids are taught in school is not relevant in the real world. There's a reason why you forget almost everything you learn after the final exam, and that is that on some level you realize you're never going to need to know it again, and you did very little practice, of course. And then there's the puzzle of, well, why do employers reward you for having jumped through all of these subjects where they don't actually need you to know them? And that's where something called the signaling model of education comes in. And, you know, this is basically a simple idea. It just says that there's really two totally different reasons why an employer might reward you for your education. One, the usual one, is you learn skills in school and they want those skills and they pay you for the skills. But a totally different reason that I say explains what's the dysfunctional part is that even when you study something that is completely useless on the job, it's still impressive. It still provides certification. It still gives you some stamps on your forehead, which convince employers, and reasonably so, that, look, if this kid could do that well in Aristotle and Latin and, you know, in medieval history, if he could do well in all those subjects, then probably we can teach him how to be a waiter at a restaurant or a secretary at this law firm or what have you.
Absolutely. Well, what's interesting about this is when we look at the history of education, like prior to, what was it, the 1830s or so, it was generally you went to college not to get practical skills. Like, that wasn't the point. The point was the general, like, the liberal arts tradition, right?
Well, although there's the liberal arts tradition itself had this idea that everyone needs to be prepared for either law, ministry, or medicine. So, I mean, the educational system we have now, it's basically sort of what someone in 1800 thought that every lawyer, doctor, and minister needed to know. All right. And if you just think about taking, like, multiple dumb ideas and then combining them and then continue to do them for another 200 years, that's what we're doing, you know, with some obvious modifications. You know, so in the late 19th century, America's top schools finally introduced natural science into the curriculum. Which is not in, yeah, I don't think that is it. That is one of the standard list of liberal arts. So they did expand the curriculum in some ways. And, you know, we have computer science, that's new, and some other subjects. But still, it seems very much, like, you know, when I say, you know, like, the fingerprints of the past are so much on the system that we have, that when you hear where the system that we have came from, it's kind of eerie. It's like, oh my God, they're basically training me to be a minister at Oxford in 1800. And now I understand why I have to learn all this stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I think there was a purity, though, in that model, right? And to be clear, I am coming from very much the humanities tradition. So I'm ABD in philosophy. And so I have my own sort of thing about that, right?
Do you know Greek and Latin?
I do not know Greek and Latin. Didn't need to, right?
You're not like a St. John's College kind of person.
No.
St. John's College got rid of Latin, and ever since it's been all downhill as far as I'm concerned.
There is a compelling case to be made for that.
Greek, French, and English. That's all an educated man needs to know.
Well, I mean, once you learn those, you can do anything, right? you know, but
not translate Latin.
Not translate Latin. No, absolutely not. But my point there is that there is a purity in sort of that humanities model, in that the point was you were going to be, and it's going to sound so very dated, but there was a point you would come out and you'd be a gentlemanly soul in the world and be able to talk about Plato and, you know, all those different types of things. But that's not really what you weren't going to school to get to create a livelihood, because you were probably already well off anyways if you went to school, right?
Yeah. And as for how many people actually became educated, enlightened gentlemen in those days, I mean, we don't have any data. Like, you know, basically the books are written by those where the program succeeded. But then there's all the other people who didn't write books who might have just found it a super boring thing or primarily a social and drinking club. You know, that fits almost everything I know about Oxford and Cambridge, that would be going on to a high degree. So,
yeah, I mean, for every one John Locke, you probably have, you know, 50,000 people that were basically flaneurs, right? Yeah. And drink coffee and talked a lot. But that was all they had to do because of renters and sort of that society at that time, right? But you're right. We've tacked on sort of like, okay, we got to retain the humanities core in some places. Actually, in some places, they've gotten rid of that. Then we've got to tack on sort of this professional doctor, lawyer, you know, sort of thing. And then we've tacked on engineering and science and things like that, right? And so we end up with this, I'm going to go to Seth Godin multiple times in this conversation, but we end up with this meatball sundae of education where we're trying to do so many different things and it's not working for the majority of people. Now, to be clear, when you say education, though, you have a very specific meaning. You're not against all education, certain types of education. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. Well, I mean, so when I say education, I mean what most people mean when they say the word education. I don't like fighting over words. So, yeah, I mean, you know, most people in their minds, they have, you know, formal schooling and things that are related to it. Although, you know, like, I mean, I will say that you know, like I did choose the title deliberately and not just to be provocative, but, you know, like you know, so I have a chapter on is education good for the soul? And there, what I'll say is, look, if education, in fact, really led to enlightened human beings, then that would be a great argument for it. But simply stating that aspiration doesn't mean it's achieved. So, and in particular, like going and taking someone who is not interested, is not curious. And, you know, like, and many people are just constitutionally so. It's not that they haven't had the right teacher. They just find abstract stuff boring. And I'll say, you know, for them, it's like the point of trying to go and force feed enlightenment down their throats while they're kicking and screaming. So, you know, like, you know, that seems to me to be just a very poor idea.
Absolutely. You know, when I used to teach philosophy, I had a few students, a few souls that would come to me towards like two thirds in the middle of the semester. And they're like, how do I know if I should major in philosophy? Right? And I said, look, there's only one litmus test. If you are at lunch and you're forgetting to eat because you're so engrossed by this idea and trying to work it out, or if you're trying to find other people to talk about with these ideas and things like that, then maybe you should do that. But if that's not happening, this is the absolute worst thing for you to do, right? Because you're going to be subjected to 4 years plus and beyond of exactly those types of things with exactly those types of people. If it's not your thing, don't do it. You can't force those types of things on people. And yet we do. Right.
Yeah, and I think many people get very agitated when you start saying if they have no interest in it, why should you force them? Some of this is just wishful thinking, and says it's all the fault of the teacher. Like, if you had just been a good teacher, 100% of kids would have found it fascinating. And it's just like, well, find me a human being that good, one, and I will kneel down before you in amazement. There is no such thing. There isn't any philosophy professor so good that 100% of randomly selected college kids will find it fascinating. Like, you know, if attendance is optional, a lot of them won't even bother to show up. I have this quote from Steven Pinker in the book, where, you know, he says, look, I'm routinely voted one of the best teachers at Harvard, and yet in the middle of the semester, half my students aren't there. So what does this tell me? So, you know, like, the best students in the world find one of the best teachers in the world boring.
Yeah.
And like, what more can you say? It's like QED.
Yeah, well, and from my tradition, like Aristotle, going all the way back there, like, he was one of the first ones, like, you know, philosophy is good for sleeping. Right. I mean, this is a philosopher saying this about, you know, his work and things like that. Right. And so, of course, he had a whole long argument about why that is and so on and so forth. But yeah.
What does he mean by that? Does it mean that you'll sleep the sleep of the just, or?
No, it means that it's boring. Right. He goes through and explains why it's boring and people who read philosophy fall asleep. Right. And this type of thing. And so it's real. I still read philosophy to fall asleep. Right. Sometimes read it in the morning too, unfortunately, and then fall asleep. But that's neither here nor there. Your argument, though, is that the primary value of education, at least as we know it now, is not the human capital argument. We get better and things like that, but it's actually that it signals something in the broader marketplace. So what do you mean by this? And two, are those signals accurate?
Yeah, so there's two very different stories about why education raises income. So, of course, there's a separate debate about how much does education raise income. But I said, all right, put all that aside. All right, here's the question of why. So one story, which is the one that people usually like, is that you go to school, they pour skills into you, and then you emerge a much better worker. And then the labor market says, hey, there's a great worker. Let's go and pay him a lot of money so that he'll come and work for me. All right, so that's called the human capital theory. So I say that, of course, there's something to that. It's not completely wrong. You learn literacy and numeracy school. That's all fine. Human capital theory works there. But then what about all the other stuff? What about the history, the social studies, the higher mathematics, the art, the music, the Shakespeare? What about the poetry? What about all this stuff? Most of the people who study this stuff still are never going to use it on the job. And yet employers still care. If you're one Aristotle class short of graduation, they may throw your application in the trash. And this is where the signaling story comes in. It says, look, the reason why this other stuff pays is because it's impressive. The very fact that you are able to do it and do it well convinces employers that you are worth hiring and training, right? And even if the stuff is itself intrinsically totally unrelated to the job, employers might still say, well, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for someone that has demonstrated that they can apply, that if they apply themselves, they can learn stuff. And therefore, if I give them something to learn, they'll probably go and apply themselves to that. A great analogy is there's two totally different ways to raise the value of a diamond. You can raise the value of a diamond by getting an expert gem cutter to cut it just perfectly to make it the most beautiful diamond in the world. That's like human capital. Or you can get a guy with one of those eyepieces to look at it and say, oh, yes, this is a flawless diamond. It's perfect. And then he puts a little sticker on the diamond. And these both cause the market price of the diamond to go up, but one transformed it and the other one simply identified its likely attributes. And so the second thing is like signaling. Now, in terms of are the signals that people perceive accurate? So this is one where I am relying upon a broader economic tradition of saying, look, if there's something that employers are doing that's really wrong and it's obvious, then someone would have figured it out and they would make a ton of money doing something else. So in the book, I don't have a lot of at least like very few papers actually demonstrating that employers' perceptions are in fact accurate. There, I am relying upon this more general economic point of look, if it really were true that high school graduates were just as good as college graduates at doing these jobs, then someone could go and pay 40% less and replace their whole college-educated workforce, and that would be an enormous amount of money, and this is really easy to do. This is not like saying you need to go and come up the four-color theorem in order to make a lot of money. This is saying that if you do something any idiot could do, which is fire all the college graduates, replace them with cheap high school graduates, if that could make money, like it sort of seems like someone have already done it, especially since it's a lot of money. Someone could be paying double the necessary price for salt, and that would not lead to massive losses because it's such a small part of the pay of the business costs. But labor is such a huge part of most business expenses that if people were making a gross error, it's hard to believe it wouldn't have been detected by now.
Well, it is, but it's not. I mean, if we take a pure economic view of it, we would think people are rational actors and they would do certain mm-hmm. types of things. Mm-hmm. If we go the more behaviorist route, right, mm-hmm. we can see that people will continue to do irrational things mm-hmm. because of other non-rational reasons, mm-hmm. right?
Some people, but again, here you'd have to think that basically every employer is doing the same dumb thing. Employers are not geniuses. They make mistakes. But, if you were to say that, look, you could go and replace the yellow jelly beans with pink jelly beans and double your money. It's like, how hard is that? Massively overpaying your workers, if you really could get ones that are just as good, that seems very hard to believe that people are doing it on much of a scale. Again, I do want to be open to the possibility of some things like this. So, I mean, one of the main uses that I put behavioral economics into the book is on the question of how do employers fire people? Mm-hmm. This is actually studied more by sociologists than by psychologists, but it's an interesting question. So at George Mason, most of our students work. So often I'll be teaching the subject and I'll ask for a show of hands. So how many people here have jobs? And 80, 90% of the students raise their hand. And I'll say, all right, so how many people are at a workforce where there's at least one worker that everybody knows is incompetent? And normally virtually every hand stays up. Mm-hmm. Virtually every person who has a job knows that there's one noticeably incompetent person there. And if you probe a bit more deeply, usually they'll usually look, well, the person's incompetent, but the business is making enough money that the person is likable enough that people don't want to get rid of them, right? And again, for a small number of incompetent people, this is believable. But if someone is their whole workforce is incompetent, their whole workforce is overpaid, now that's the kind of thing that is really going to kill a business. So be very, very hard to stay around there. I mean, again, and like to me, like the interesting question is this: how many people are there who never would have been hired if the employer had foreseen how good they would be? And again, normally these incompetent people, they wouldn't have been hired, if this had been foreseen. Normally they're there because once they're there, either they're not good, but it would be so much work to replace them that you just settle for a poor worker, or they're really incompetent and then people just pity them, and especially if it's the really nice and competent worker. And then sort of the last interesting thing is that in what you can call the termination community, the people who specialize in firing people, mm-hmm. or getting rid of workers, they've come up with a very interesting concept which they call dehiring. So this is you want to get rid of a worker. Well, we don't want to fire them. Fine, let's dehire them. What does that mean? It means help them get another job, and pretty much just conspire with this person to trick their next employer, so that when the next employer figures out what you've done to them, they too are in the same position that you're in, where they're like, well, I don't know, maybe we should just live with this person. Now, this is all interesting in terms of the thesis of the book, because if employers were willing to give someone a chance and then immediately fire you as soon as they decide that you aren't working out, then you might say, well, signaling could help you for a little while, but it's not going to have much of a payoff, because very quickly people will see the truth and that'll be the end of the gravy train. But if people are willing to keep overpaying you after they see the truth, and if when they get rid of you, they help you to move to another victim, then it's much, much more plausible that an inaccurate signal, when it occurs, really pays you for a very long time and is actually a great deal. So, several times at least a couple times in the book, I asked the hypothetical of, which you'd rather have, a Princeton education without a Princeton diploma, or a Princeton diploma without the education? Right. And my slogan is, if you have to think about this, you already agree with me.
Yeah.
Because if the very fact that you deliberate shows that you think it's a tough call. And if it's a tough call, this means that you think signaling must be pretty important. By contrast, if I asked you, on a desert island, would you rather have a boat building degree or knowledge of boat building? Everyone knows, well, yeah, I'd rather have knowledge of boat building than the degree, because that's what I need to save my life. But in the labor market, it's very different. There, you might really rather have the credential than the knowledge.
Yeah, well, I will say, working on this side in industry with hirers and things like that, whether it makes me a pessimist about humans, about people, what I will say, though, is I've worked with plenty of people. It's like, man, we got to give them another chance because they've got this degree and they've got the potential. And it's the same thing as the difference between buying an Escalade versus an Avalanche, right? Or sort of the cars that are the same thing, except for one has a better status symbol. Mm-hmm. People, there are enough people to do that create a macro trend, right. And so.
Yeah. So there is the story that you want to have people with these fancy degrees to impress customers, right? And actually, early in the history of the signaling model, there's some people who said, well, why don't we just compare the payoff of a Harvard degree in self-employment versus working for someone else? And then someone said, yeah, but a self-employed person might use the Harvard degree to impress their customers and to signal the customers. And then it's like, oh yeah, so actually I guess self-employment isn't really actually much of a solution to this problem. It sounds plausible at first, but on second thought, it isn't really that good of a test.
Yeah, and when you look at a lot of the major consulting firms, BCG, McKinsey, so on and so forth, they mm-hmm. recruited all these high signal schools to get mm-hmm. them on there, because when they pitch a proposal, mm-hmm. it's like, well, we've got the PhDs and so on and so forth.
Yes.
Regardless of whether they can actually deliver, but that's what gets bought.
Yes. Yeah, although, it scores much easier to pursue that strategy if 95% of the people from Harvard are good.
Yes,
if it were a totally misleading signal, if 95% of the people from Harvard were unable to read or write, then it would be a big problem to go and hire just based upon the shine of the degree, because then who would do the actual work?
Who would do the actual work? This is absolutely true, but that's the thing. So what we're talking about here, signaling is one of those either branches mm-hmm. of optics, right? And mm-hmm. there are different ways in which the optics can create value or can create perceived value that continue something that makes no sense going on, right?
Yeah. I've often thought that if I were actually running my own business, that I would just wander around the world, and whenever I saw a person who seemed to be better than their job, I would just go and give them my card and say, I think you're meant for better things, and come work for me. I remember once I was at Noodles and Company, and there was the cashier who seemed, my God, you seem so, you could do tons of stuff, but you're a cashier here. If only I actually ran a business, I would hire you on the spot and say come work for me. But part of what I do in the book is say, look, even if employers were to go in and figure out who's not good after a few months, This wouldn't solve the problem of what about the people who never even get observed for a few months? What about the people I call the diamonds in the rough, someone who is awesome, but you never actually, but you don't actually even give them an interview because they don't have the right credentials? And how can we find those people? And again, what I'm saying is, you know, like if you are someone like that, like in the modern economy, you often feel like you have almost no real choice other than to jump through the normal hoops because no one will even give you a chance to look at you. But again, this makes, you know, if there's like three diamonds in the rough and a stack of 100 losers, it makes sense to throw them all away.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I don't have time to find the three people out of 100 who are good, because that would involve like, you know, maybe multiple interviews, and like, you know, time is money. So time is money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I'll say, and granted, I'm not a career strategist or anything like that, but I did stay in Holiday Inn Express one time. I should stop telling that joke. Anyways, the thing about it is employers are looking for people who have done something and have built something, right? And so if you're one of those diamonds, a lot are, right? A lot.
Well, I mean, maybe for the like very, very prestigious jobs. I mean, like, you know, if you're hiring someone to work at your hotel, you're not looking for someone to build, who's built anything.
It depends, actually, right? If you if you're dealing with people who are just, you know, resume jamming, which is a thing that people do, versus someone that's actually built something and has some initiative and spunk and so on, you have an edge. And so my point here is, you know, the lack of an education can be a downside in the market where we're talking about, right? It can be easily overcome in some places. Right. And some places with
literally true, but misleading. I mean, sure, there's like some places on Earth where that can occur. But, you know, there was a book that I footnoted in The Case Against Education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was called like something like How to Succeed Without College.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the whole book. And at the end of it, it's like, OK, I still don't have any. You haven't told me any of the practical, actual, usable strategy for how to do this. It's a great title. But like, again, a lot of the advice was things like, well, informally take some college classes and impress the professor. Like, all right, if I could do that, then maybe I should just done the regular thing. It seemed like most of the advice was, you know, either that or just like, you know, like get a patent on a great invention. Like, oh, well, that's helpful.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are those types of things, but I think there are general skills. This is one of the reasons why, well, there's also signaling at play is for veterans and you know, people who come from those, like they can demonstrate that they've done certain things in the world through their careers. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that is something that they can leverage. Now, I'm not going to tell everyone to go out and become a soldier because you're going to get hired afterwards, because that's not the reason you'd want to do something like that.
Right. And there is at least one famous paper in economics saying that people that lost the draft lottery for Vietnam and went actually wound up earning less than people who went. So those other people, like, it'd be like, again, like, this is the kind of thing where it had come out that the veterans did better than everyone is saying, well, see, the military goes and trains you and prepares you. But then it comes out the other way. It's like, well, I guess giving people a lot of military experience isn't that helpful for civilian jobs. I'm actually kind of a little bit surprised, because I would have thought the military would at least sort of whip people into shape.
Yeah, you know, that's a surprising outcome. So I might, after the show, ask you to send me that report, the general skills that we look across broad degrees of industries are ones that the military tends to instill in people, right? Yeah. And so it's surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so probably in Vietnam, most of these guys are just getting sent to the infantry.
Yeah.
So that's especially not really useful.
It'll be hard to say for 30, 40 years past. What I can say is the modern training.
Very plausible that it's completely different. So what would just like grunts in the military be? Would that even be 20% of the military now?
About a tenth.
Yeah.
I'm about a tenth. About a tenth. So it's much, much smaller.
Like just like a guy with a gun and some boots.
And it's also harder. Like that image of a guy in a gun, like, it's so much harder, and there are so many more educational requirements for the very reason we're talking about, that it takes like to even be a mid-level sergeant anymore. You have to have some college degree, you know, some college time and things like that. So I think people's understanding of people in the military is maybe stuck in the 50s or the 60s, not where it actually is right now.
Yeah.
And to that point, I mean, one of the frustrating things as a military officer, for instance, to become a commissioned officer, you have to have a college degree, right? Doesn't matter what the degree is or where it's from.
I've seen this in PhD programs too.
Right.
I need to get a PhD in something or other. How about economics?
Yeah. And so, you know, it's that same point. It signals something. That was always my point. What are we saying here? Right.
So for government jobs, that's where I'm much more willing to say that it's just a dysfunction. Like it doesn't even make sense from the point of view of the people imposing the rules. because there, it's, you know, it's nonprofit, it's taxpayer supported, so you could do something, you could do totally wasteful stuff, and what's going to happen to you? Again, like it's in the for-profit sector where you've got multiple firms that are competing or could compete, that saying that things are totally messed up seems impossible to me. Whereas, you know, at least if it's going on, you know, but you know, like if it's going on in the like in the tax-funded sector, that's where I'd say, well, maybe like you know, like why don't they do it better? Well, what's in it for me to save some taxpayer money? What's the point?
Yeah. Well. Yeah, it's clear that there's a meta level discussion about the degree to which irrationality, and I don't like would much more want to go Kahneman's perspective on this, but a certain way of the reasons that we have are not always the same the reasons that we would think they would be, and yes. To what degree yes. Can those reasons dictate broad trends in society?
Right. Although notice, so like even Richard Thaler, you know, closely associated with Kahneman, when he goes over things like stock market anomalies, he repeatedly admits that these are not get rich quick schemes by any means, and that the errors that people are making are sufficiently small that even when you know it, it doesn't give you a big edge. And in fact, you need to maybe spend thousands of years investing to reliably expect to do much better than chance, or than the regular strategy rather.
Yeah.
So immediately, like you. So you know, like at least out of, like for a lot of behavioral economists, when they go and highlight anomalies, they like if you read them closely, you'll find out they are not saying that people are leaving millions of dollars on the table. They're saying that it is like a small percentage gain, which if you were a billionaire, maybe you could make 10,000 extra dollars. But then again, if you're a billionaire, how pressing of a concern is that?
Yeah, like, oh my God. It's always tricky especially because as you know, it's sample size and where you're looking, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. But to this point, like for instance, I think our society's fascination with burials make no sense whatsoever.
Right? Did you say
burials, like burying bodies and putting them in the ground and graveyards and cemeteries? Yeah. Like when you add it all up, it mm-hmm. there's no conceivable way in which it makes any sense, right? And yet. It's a broad, you know, it's a thing in our society, right?
Yeah, but it's not like the industry is screwing up. It's, you know, people go and put a lot of their money in, and probably so some of it just because they're really sad and they feel like they've got to go and do something. And then other people, I have known people who actually admitted to my face, well, if no one else were paying attention, I'd just go and put them in a cardboard box and that'd be it. But I don't want other people to talk.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I've told Angela to put me in a Folger scan, right? I'm like, it doesn't matter at a certain point. But my point is that things like that can create broad trends in our society that you wouldn't think would have that effect. And education.
It's much easier for a consumer to be dysfunctional because, you know, if you go and spend, you know, five times the money you need for toothpaste, it doesn't really work. It's not like you don't die. It probably doesn't even change the number of offspring you have. So there isn't any good selection mechanism. Whereas in business, you know, there really is some very good work showing that over the long run, there is a much higher attrition rate for businesses with low productivity, much higher survival and growth rate for businesses with high productivity. So again, this is not just a priori. This is actually, you know, there's like a guy at Maryland named Haltewanker who's done tremendous work on this, showing that there is great empirical wisdom in this perception that in the long run, it's very hard for a business that with excessive costs to stay around because that, you know, like if you don't cut your costs, somebody else that does will take over your business.
Yeah. I think we're saying the same thing. My perspective might be that businesses can act more like consumers. Mm-hmm. Just in the sense of not following the data, just at large, right?
Yeah, it can be. It's just that when a business, you know, so a business can die in a way that an individual can't, and a business can get bigger in a way that no human can. A business can grow by a factor of 1,000. No human being can turn into 1,000 people.
This is true. It's a self-fulfilling thing. Like the signaling and everything, the optics that happen with businesses mm-hmm. is what makes the difference. And so you can, I mean, it's the 2008 sort of thing. You can push things around enough until there ends up being a break. And there's just not enough people pushing against that to really, unless, you know, you get Amazon and Jeff Bezos and coming through that's just, you know, taking things out because they're just saying, like, there are different disruptors that do those things that question mm-hmm. the very things that we're talking about. Right. Like, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this. And enough of them. But again, that's sort of a macro thing about the way, mm-hmm. you know, our economy can work with mm-hmm. with bugs in the system, as it were. Yeah. You know, we've been dancing around a lot of different things, which I really, really appreciate. But aside from just a rant, you actually have policy mm-hmm. perspectives and proposals. And your first of those policy points is that the government needs to cut sharply from education funding to end the race, as it were. Walk us through that, and sort of while you're at it, how would this not make life considerably worse for people from lower economic statuses?
Mm-hmm. Right. So just the background, there has been enormous credential inflation in over the past few decades where, so of course, over time, like there has been some shift to more intellectually demanding jobs like, computer science, IT. But most of what's happened in the economy is that if one and the same job that your grandfather could have done with a high school degree, you need a college degree for now. Right. And again, this is mostly from sociologists who just spend a lot of time crunching these numbers and saying, wow, for one and the same job, you now need a lot more education to get it. Doesn't seem like you need more education to do it, just to get it, mm-hmm. right? And this is exactly what Sigling predicts will happen as education levels rise. The more education that the applicants have, the more education employers expect you to have in order to consider you worthy of employment. Because a lot of what they're doing is they're saying, well, we want to get someone who's in the top third. And if the top third is high school graduation, then high school graduation's enough. If the top third is college, then college graduation's enough. If the top third got to be a master's degree or PhD, you might need to have those in order to get a halfway decent job. So, the background is that there has been this big change, which is very much what is predicted by the Sigling model. And the question in my mind is, how can we get credential deflation? How can we return the world to a situation or the economy situation where you could get a good job right out of high school, right? And if my logic is sound, if the reason why you need so much more today is because people have so much more today, then the way that you can get credential deflation is by reducing the amount of education that people have, right? And the surest way of doing this is for the funding to be cut. There's a lot of work out there on how increased government funding encourages education. Most of this work is done by people who are very eager to argue for more education spending. But the logic works just as well in reverse. Say, look, if you think that we actually have too much education and we're having too many people spending many years in school studying subjects they don't really need to know or aren't interesting to them, then if we were to go and change the funding, this would change the number of people do it. Now, again, you're exactly right about the fear that clutches people at this point, because they start picturing a talented kid from a poor family who can't go to college and then is stuck working a car wash his whole life, right? And my answer to that is that's a reasonable prediction if only one person has their funding cut. But I'm not talking about cutting the funding for one person. I'm talking about cutting the funding for a whole generation, right? And how does that help? Well, because when there is a general reduction in the amount of education that people have, it changes the meaning of the degree. It changes it so it no longer means I am one person who didn't feel like going to college and I don't care what you say. Instead, it says I'm part of a vast number of people that didn't go. And no longer do you then stand out as someone who had an issue or was lazy or not smart enough or not conformist enough. So again, so I was just looking at the numbers. So like back after World War II, like about half of people in upper management would never have been to college. Never have been to college, right? Mm-hmm. And what this means is, now, of course, almost all of them do go to college. And again, so the main difference in the world then and the world now is that now almost everyone that would actually be good enough does go. And so there's just very little room left for someone who lacks the degree. I'd say, wouldn't it be great if we went back to a world where employers once again were open-minded? And how do you make them more open-minded? By making open-mindedness reasonable. If one person in 1,000 who's good enough for upper management doesn't have the degree, then you're not going to be open-minded. It's like it's too much work to find them. But if half the people that are good enough didn't go to college, this changes. So the way that I often tell my students is, look, without all this government support, a lot of you couldn't afford to be here. That's the bad news. Here's the offset of good news. You wouldn't need to be here. Employers would not have this snobby attitude. They couldn't afford to throw away half the applications from people, half the applications of people that are good, right? So, it seems to me that people are hyper focused on the really talented kid from a poor family who has a better time today, but they're not at all interested in all the other kids from poor families who don't do well in school and then have almost no options at all. And I say, at minimum, we should remember those kids too. When you're concerned about equality of opportunity, you should remember not only the lucky few, but the unlucky majority, right? So, it's not like it's very uncommon for kids from poor families to graduate from college even today. So, and again, imagine a world where kids in that position still were in the running for good jobs, right? Which they used to be and now are not.
Yeah, we can go a long time about that last little thread about, mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily talking about the uber talented kids, mm-hmm. right? I'm just, you know, looking at sort mm-hmm. of the middle classization mm-hmm. of education. I am curious though, because what we also see in the marketplace though, is that when something is at, it's supply demand, right? When there are fewer mm-hmm. number of people with degrees, mm-hmm. there's, I'm curious about it because it also seems like those people with degrees would mm-hmm. have a higher sort of optical perspective. Like mm-hmm. we would value them even more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's completely reasonable. And it is actually built right into my number crunching when I actually go over this. But again, so this is saying that, the simplest, if you imagine that you line everyone up on a scale of ability from 0 to 100, so if right now, if say you have in a world where half, where the top half all go to college, mm-hmm. then like the average ability of that group will be at 75, like average of 50 and 100. Mm-hmm. And the average ability of the people who don't will be way down at 25 from 0 to 50, right? And then imagine a world where only a few people go, like only the top 10% go. Then their average is 95 and the average of the bottom group would be 45. Right. So, I mean, it's true that the people in that very top remaining group are going to do even better than they do today. But there's going to be a much larger group of people that are doing much better. And essentially, insofar as signaling is true, the average is actually unchanged, but it's actually better to be in the low group in a world where there's a lot of good people in the low group.
Fantastic. Because I was hoping. I was hoping we pulled out sort of the Rawlsian framework on this one, right?
Yeah.
Where like if you had to choose an option,
yeah, right, would you rather be in a world where you can get a good job right out of high school or not?
Yes. And well,
yeah, that sounds a lot better to be able to get a good job right out of high school. And even the fact that the kids who graduate from college are seen as really stellar in this world. Well, but still, like you can get a good job out of high school. So that's for a lot of people, that's of course that'd be very attractive just so they don't have to go, but also just to say, hey, my fallback is just better.
Yeah. I'll need to think about them. We might have an email exchange or something, or I just do a lot of writing about it. I do wonder about the long-term power repercussions, right? Mm-hmm. Of just it's the 1% model over and over again. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's neither here nor there. At a certain point, it's better for more people to be able to get good jobs.
Right. Right. And also if you just look at the late 19th century and look at all of the moguls who had very humble educations. Right. I mean, there's always a 1% by definition. A 1% must exist. Mm-hmm. But again, it seems better if the 1% is based more on actual job performance rather than this educationally based forecast, which is true on average, but still leaves a lot of diamonds in the rough that are just unfound and their talent just doesn't get appreciated.
See, I'm unconvinced that it would actually be on job performance, though. But that might be mm-hmm. a priori, or there might be something mm-hmm. else that I need to argue for. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's part of the conversation we had previously. Yeah. But
one funny thing is, it's actually not economists who spend a lot of time showing the connection between job performance and success. It's actually psychologists. So the whole field of industrial psychology, economists usually just treat it all as a black box, but industrial psychologists try to measure productivity through a lot of different ways. So they actually study the thing that we assume. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm always trying to get economists, hey, stop making fun of psychology. They're actually looking at important things and they have useful things. Sometimes they say we're exactly right. Sometimes they find problems. We're more likely to hear about the problems than the confirmation, but let's learn it all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm married to a sociologist. And so we end up having a lot of fun conversations about mm-hmm. what we think versus what the data actually shows, and social psychologist at that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, sort of the social philosophy of me and thinking from that lens, I'm like, let's play some of this out, but also let's look at the research. You've done more of the looking at the research than I have. But on the second point though, the second policy thing, I actually am 100% behind you. I was like, and as I was saying in the green room, this is going to be one of those because I really agree with you. But the other thing that we can do is actually advocate for and push more for vocational education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so in this case, why does vocational education get sort of the green light when it could create sort of the same scenario?
Well, so two reasons. So, I mean, the easy one is there is quite a bit of research saying that vocational education is just selfishly better for a lot of students. A typical student would be better to have a bit more vocational education than they do in terms of their long run wages and employment. And then students who hate school would be better because they're so likely to drop out or end up in jail, better to go and train them for something that they're good at and like than to keep trying to keep them on the college for all track, which is almost certainly not going to work for them. Mm-hmm. But the connection to signaling is just this: say, far better to use taxpayer money to train people how to do something useful than to get them to jump through hoops. The jumping through hoops, the more people do it, the more you have to do. But on the other hand, actual practical skills, that's something where you are growing the pie in the process of raising the income of the person who gets it, right? And I just go over the advantages, you know, countries where mm-hmm. where they have a bigger role for vocational education, like Germany and Switzerland. And then what is the main problem with it? And, you know, so there, like, a lot of it is just from the top down, there's immense propaganda against it. Usually by default, it's not like there's a daily announcement from your principal saying, "I just want you to know that anyone who does vocational education is a loser." All right, that's rare. But instead, you get the principal saying, "And we want to know that every one of our students will go to college." And when you say that, just by default, you are insulting and demeaning every other possible path to success in life. And I see, so we see that is really built into the current system, which is based upon the idea of training every kid for college, regardless of actual statistical likelihood of that working out for them, right? And again, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, like, double standard arguments against vocational education, like, well, vocational education is bad because maybe what you're being trained for won't really be needed in the labor market by the time you get there. It's like, oh yeah, that's true. How about giving kids a poetry class? What are the odds that's going to be needed when they get out there? Look, poetry, we know it already isn't needed. It's already a total pipe dream. And if there's any confident forecast we can make about the economy of the future, it's that poetry is not going to get any bigger than it is now. All right. So to go and say, like, we shouldn't trade kids as plumbers because maybe there'll be plumbing robots in a few decades. Look, at least we know there's a lot of jobs for plumbers now. So start with what exists. And secondly, like, next thing is to go and try to look at forecasts about employment. They're not perfect, but it's better to go and make your best guess than deliberately keep teaching people the curriculum of 1800, which has been obsolete forever, if it ever made any sense in the first place, which it never did.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go further. I think most of those rationalizations are complete bullshit, not because they're factually, not because they're false, but because what they're hiding over is that, like, a lot of parents don't want their kid to grow mm-hmm. up to be a plumber, right? Yeah. That's not sort of that you want mm-hmm. them to be the president or the doctor, right. All these sort of things, yeah. Right? But it's like, you know, that's not something that people are super proud of for all the sort of societal signal to, and, yeah. and our general sort of, you know, perspective about people who work in the trades. And if you really want to have, like, a lot of kids will end up asking me, like, I don't know what I want to do, don't know what college I want to go to. And I'm like, have you considered going to a trade school or maybe going to the military or maybe going to, mm-hmm. you know, some of these other things? And they've never actually thought about it. Like, yeah, that's sure. an option,
right?
Mm-hmm. To do. And I'm like, well, no sense in going and spending a bunch of money to figure out what the hell you want to do with your life and then have that thing that you're buying not actually help you do that thing, right? There are different options, right, that you can do here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think what you're saying is totally right. There's just a ton of parental resistance too. No kid of mine is going to do that. But you're worth pointing out, you know, there are also plenty of what we can think of neglectful parents who just aren't very interested in their kids and don't have a strong opinion and, like, aren't even doing the basic stuff for their kids, sadly. And for those kids, it seems pretty likely that if you had guidance counselors and teachers saying, we think you'd be a good plumber or electrician, I don't think those parents, you know, the parents who can't even be bothered to make sure their kids aren't getting drunk, aren't drunk at school, they're probably not going to go and interfere with their kid becoming a plumber. So I'd say that, like, you know, there's a lot of kids right now who just detest school and statistically are likely to end up in jail, who the system actually, if it were willing to just go and do the unthinkable of saying, we don't think this kid's going to, like, it seems kid, like, the kid's unlikely to do well in college. Let's find a better path for him. That, I mean, I think in those cases, you know, at least there's enough parents that would not interfere that there's no excuse for not expanding it. So yeah, well, you know, it's one thing if you say, like, this kid would be a great plumber, but his parents say no. Well, what are you going to do? You can't overrule the parents. But what if there's a kid, look, the kid hates school. We think he'd be a good plumber, and his parents are AWOL. His parents are barely paying attention to him. You know, so, you know, like, and how about for a kid like that? So, you know, like, you know, and again, this is the case again where people are like, oh, so kids, you know, kids from bad neighborhoods with neglectful parents should all be plumbers. Like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying, if there's a kid who would be good at it and enjoy it and the parents aren't stopping him foolishly, you know, basically, if there's a kid whose parents are messing him up in a bunch of other ways, but at least is failing to stop him from doing a good thing that is a good idea for him, why not take advantage of that situation to go and give the kid a better life? Like, why, like, again, like these scruples that people have of, look, everyone should try college once, and if they fail out and waste a year of life and a lot of money, then they can try plumbing.
Like, yeah. I mean,
you know, I think a lot of people at that point don't feel like trying plumbing. A lot of people at that point feel like robbing a liquor store. They're so frustrated with the situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's unlikely that I'm going to write the book about the case of against education, because you've already done it, and you've done a great job with it. But what I would say, if I had a wish, it's like, let's just delay any discussion of college until people are 22. Right. Like, that's,
yes,
like, let them have 4 years of doing different things. Right.
Yes.
And let's not make it the damn default option.
Yeah.
That, 'cause mm-hmm. we know the default option is not working for a whole hell of a lot of people, but they get funneled into it anyways. And so I think it's a really good question for parents and kids in our society to be asking, what do we do with kids who are 18 to 22 that are not just, you know, in another educational purgatory? Right.
Whenever there's someone who comes and says, look, I'm a practical man and I believe that kids should have a gap year where they get a job or something. Whenever I meet people like that, I'm always like, oh, yes, you've fallen right into my plan. You know, because you know what? I think a lot of kids who take a gap year will never go, especially if they get a job, they learn some real skills and make some decent money. There's a lot of people at the margin who, if you just give them any breather from the system and show them anything else, will decide, look, I don't like this. Why do I have to do more of it? So, you know, so from the point of view of someone who wants to make sure their kid stays in school, then I think that your idea is probably bad. But on the other hand, for someone who wants them to get real skills and become independent adults, your idea is great.
Yeah, well,
and that is the better approach, I think.
Yeah, well, that's implicit. The latter one is, like, I don't think that should be the default option for a lot of different reasons, right? And now there are some people who have been a math prodigy since they were 14, right? Now what are you going to do if you're a math prodigy in certain ways? You know, like, there are certain outcomes that are going to go, or maybe you just really do want to be an engineer that requires a certain type of formal training and things like that. Now, what I believe Brian is saying, and I'm saying the same thing, is that, yes, we can create outcomes for them. We can create pathways for them. We're not saying they shouldn't go to college.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, again, like, still, it might be nice to have some curriculum reform, but yeah, I mean, so, you know, like, people in CS, they're learning a lot of useful stuff. You know, they may have to take a couple classes in computer theory, which they don't need to know, but it's not like this utterly dysfunctional thing that it is for so many other majors.
Yeah. And so,
socially dysfunctional.
Not
saying it's selfishly dysfunctional, but so, you know, again, for them, you know, for people that did poorly in high school, I think it's dysfunctional selfishly as well as socially. But that's a separate question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to slide this in. I need to do more than just a formal polling of my friends. But what's interesting is so many people who graduate with the humanities degrees end up not reading a lot of the stuff that they thought they would. Like, they stop reading or they stop doing the thing, right? And my only point about that is, you know, there's sort of an argument that it's going to lead to sort of this lifelong ability to do things, but turns out not to be the case, right? Like, there are some of us who still continue to do so, but anyways, that's neither here nor there. Just thinking
it is kind of here. I do have a chapter where I talk about that, and just, you know, when people say, well, it's very important for education, education's great because it leads to this lifelong enlightenment, and like, well, that's the aspiration. Is that actually true? And then, so why don't we just look at like book sales for the classics, or classical music sales, or like other, like, how much high culture do people voluntarily consume? And again, it's such a small amount that I think you really have to say the current system just fails at instilling any kind of any noticeable amount of sincere affection for high culture. It's just a fact.
Well, and I think it's always been that way. Like, this is not a new trend. People don't read the classics anymore. 200 years ago, people didn't read the classics anymore, right? 200 years ago, before that, they didn't read the classics anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
So what's great about podcasts like yours is that it does open up these opportunities for the life of mine for people who have jobs and are busy or later in life. And, you know, like, there's a total niche market of intellectually vibrant people out there. A lot of them are not kids. A lot of them are older people. Or like maybe the best class ever taught at George Mason is the Learning and Retirement Institute here. Where they're all retirees, and I go and I talk, and they're like, they are so happy to learn and so curious, but they are self-selected to be there. So again, like, I'm not saying people like this don't exist, but the idea that the current system has created a world where there's a noticeable appreciation of this stuff is wrong. You know, like, you know, to me, I'm just grateful that the internet allows us to go and reach this very dispersed audience of curious people who are there, but often they're so spread out geographically, you can never bring them into a physical classroom. but we can all be in this great virtual classroom together, and you know, we can light a candle against the darkness, even though the world's full of darkness.
Yeah. Well, I think it's true learning when you show up in that sort of thing. Like, I'm legitimately interested in it. I want to take it. I want to chew on it. I want this to inform and change my life. Like, that's true learning and things like that, which I love. But, you know, a lot of educators get to the point that once you get realistic about it, you realize you're probably going to reach 20% of the kids on a good day. Right. Yep. That's really who... Yep. And the 80% are just there because they have to be there, or they're just biding time. They're trying to get the grade. Yep. And you talk about that. And that's really frustrating. It's much better to have people who show up to your podcast or to your course, or they're like, I want to be here. I want to learn this. I want to be a part of this conversation.
Bingo.
All right. So what has been the most compelling rebuttal you've heard to your thoughts, and how have you incorporated it or worked through it?
Yeah, so there's an economist named Eric Hangashek, who I actually had the privilege of debating a couple weeks ago. And in some ways, he's on the same page as me, because he starts off by saying, look, mere years of education don't really predict much about national prosperity. Just throwing money or resources at education doesn't seem to be very predictive. And so, you know, so far, he's on the same page as me. Then he says, but what really is super predictive of especially national prosperity is national test scores, especially like math and science scores. So roughly what he wants to do is to reorient the whole education system towards the direction of boosting math and science scores. And rather than cutting spending, say, let's just go and redirect it towards getting learning up to a really high level. Right. And so, you know, like, I think it's a reasonable approach. My rebuttal to him, twofold. So first of all, I just say pragmatically, the system has been wasting so much money for so long, I just don't trust them to go and reform. Say, look, sure, you can go and tell schools, look, from now on, when you get this $1 trillion a year, we expect you to teach kids lots of math and science. You'd better. And they're like, oh, sure, we'll make sure we do it. Yeah, and then they'll keep doing the same thing they always have. So I just don't believe that they're going to change. I mean, like, they the current system, they like doing it the way they're doing, and they don't want accountability, and they don't want to have to go and be responsible for teaching lots of math and science successfully. You know what I mean? They like the pure input model where teaching is trying to teach, not action, rather than learning. But my more fundamental objection to Hangashek is this. See, it just doesn't make much sense that math and science would have these great social effects, since the typical job uses little math and virtually no science. So I say what's more likely is that he's actually picking up the effects of intelligence rather than math and science. And again, it makes a lot more sense for national intelligence to have a big effect upon national prosperity, because we're always using our intelligence all the time. Every job requires intelligence. But I go months before in between using biology on the job. So I say what, you know, and again, now intelligence is not actually fixed. There is, again, and this is, there is tons of research showing there's lots of ways of changing intelligence. For example, adopting infants at birth and moving them to Sweden is a great way to raise their intelligence, and it totally works. So again, I'm not saying this is fixed or fundamentally genetic or anything like that, but I am saying that intelligence is much harder to change than just math and science scores. Math and science scores, you just go and teach them the information, drill, 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 practice, 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 you can get those scores up. It's, but on the other hand, much harder just to go and give people some classes and make them smarter. And like, it requires much more fundamental changes, much more wider ranging. It can't just be in school. You gotta have to basically like change their entire life.
Yeah.
Right, so you know, again, I'm not saying that this is hopeless, but I am saying that I think he's picking up something that school alone is only gonna make a very small dent in. And he's just mistaking a symptom of intelligence for something that's much more fundamental.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't push STEM in that way because mm-hmm. I think you're going to, but mm-hmm. I would push much more on critical thinking and reasoning and mm-hmm. decision making mm-hmm. and things like that. Is that being a focus of education? Because those are things that I think will bear out across in mm-hmm. every industry and be closer. But
right. Well, there's a lot of research in educational psychology on critical thinking, and the main punchline is that critical thinking is super hard to teach, and especially it's super hard to get people to apply it outside the classroom. It's one thing to have a class called critical thinking with a final exam that says critical thinking final exam with a bunch of critical thinking problems on it. That you may be able to improve. But to actually get the students to take those habits of thought and use them anywhere outside of the classroom, or indeed to even retain that improvement for years after the final exam, those are things, it's very hard to find much evidence that it happens. Right? And it's depressing. But again, you know, but what I'll say is the people that are doing this research, they want to find the effect you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they come away shell-shocked and saying, we haven't found it. What's wrong?
I totally agree. for different reasons. But yeah, it's super hard. What are we testing for? That becomes, what are we optimizing in our society? Is the broader question, right? And we can optimize towards science and math. We can optimize these sort of things. And I think some of those are going to be incredibly hard to test for.
So it means like critical thinking, if you're interested in critical thinking, I encourage you to read the research, because there's some really great research that's been done. I mean, even things on the order, one of my favorite experiments involved giving people a bunch of questions that tap critical reasoning, but are very unlike anything you're likely to learn here in any class. Mm-hmm. One question was, this was in the 80s. So they actually tape recorded the responses and then had judges score the quality of the number and quality of the arguments. But like one question was, what would be the effect on litter of a five cent bottle deposit? Right. And then again, like some good things, right? Well, 5 cents, that does give an incentive, but doesn't seem like a very big incentive. And then on the other hand, bottles are only a small part of litter. But on the third hand, perhaps this would lead to some people actually collecting bottles all day as a job. And again, they just recorded what people said about these kinds of things and put that out on. And this kind of thing where you'll see the people with more education do quite a bit better on these kinds of tests, but they don't improve during the course of their program. So if you go and look at compare the freshmen versus the seniors in college, almost exactly the same scores. So they do better than the high school graduates, but this looks very much like it was just selection and they didn't actually improve causally as a result of the education. Because again, they're so rarely are they called upon to actually do general critical thinking. It's always so circumscribed. And again, there's famed Harvard psychologist Howard Gardner with his multiple intelligences. Mm-hmm. But one of the main things that he's talked about is inert knowledge. So this is what you do is you get physics students who can do all the problems. They get A's in the class. And then outside of the classroom, you give them a video game that operates along the principles of Newtonian physics, and they don't do it right because they keep using their intuitive physics, which is wrong, right? And objects at rest remain at rest in the classroom, but not in the playground. Right? I guess the other one, like objects in motion remain in motion in the classroom, but on the playground, on the other hand, they naturally decelerate.
Yeah, right. and
stuff like that.
To that point, I'm also talking about what we would teach in philosophy, of course, right? Of being able to point out, informal fallacies and ways of thinking and bugs in the system and things like that. I'm including that as part of that, but we don't have much evidence of how that turns out. We don't have much evidence of it being taught, right?
Yeah, how many philosophy majors talk philosophy outside of school?
If they are around other philosophy majors, quite a lot.
Yes, but those are the selected ones.
Yes.
Yeah, but your normal, the median philosophy major whose friends are not fellow philosophers, how often are they applying philosophical concepts in their daily conversation? I don't think
it's hard to tell.
I was a philosophy minor, so to my mind, hardly ever.
Yeah.
Again, there's the cream of the cream, the people who are the future philosophy professors. So they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, economics is actually even worse than philosophy in this regard. So I would say for economics, even most econ professors do not regularly apply economics outside of a professional context. So if the fraction of econ professors who walk out of movies compared to normal people, I don't think it's much greater than normal people, even though this is the most this is what you should have learned in econ first week of econ one.
Yep. Sunk cost, right?
Yeah. Sunk cost fallacy. And yet, like most economists, even econ professors that I met, they're still normal people rather than people who have deeply internalized what they've learned and try to live up to it.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think we can apply that to just about every other way in which we might educate people that outside of the context in which there's a performance aspect of it, they don't use it, right?
Yeah.
And so...
And this is why a big part of the case against education is that even when there could be very wide-ranging benefits of a class, that doesn't mean they really happen, and normally they don't.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking at the time, and obviously I think we could talk forever and go different directions, but I really appreciate your time. We're going to go ahead and wrap this one up.
All right.
Brian, as the guest to today's podcast, you get to leave our listeners with an invitation or a challenge based upon what we've talked about. So what would you invite or challenge our listeners to do?
That's an interesting question. So, how about this? How about you just go through the list of courses in whatever your last formal year of education was, and just compare those classes to what you're doing today, and see how often do you see any connection at all, right? I think that that's I mean, it's a little bit depressing, but it's a fair trial, and fair test of what I'm saying. Oh, and by the way, so my book, The Case Against Education, is only $20 on Amazon. So the real question to ask is, can you afford not to buy it? I don't. I think the answer has got to be no, right?
Absolutely has to be no. So absolutely. Yes. For your kids, for your neighbors, right?
Everyone needs their own copy. You don't want to fight with your friends and children for possession of the copy. So just get multiple copies. It'll all work out.
Brian, it's been fantastic talking to you today.
All right. Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Okay, listeners, so you heard it from Brian. Go back and look at the last year of your education, whether that's undergraduate, whether that's graduate, whatever it is, and see how closely that knowledge, those courses are applied to or are relevant to what you do day in, day out. It's a litmus test to the degree of how well that may have served you. If you do this and you see, great, did help me, that's fantastic. But we also want to think about what we're doing with the next generation of kids and educators so that we can use our limited resources on something that makes a lot more sense. Until next time, stand tall. Thanks for listening to Productive Flourishing. To get more resources that'll help you finish the work that matters and be your best self in the world, head on over to ProductiveFlourishing.com. If this episode warmed your heart or got your wheels turning, we'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a review for the podcast on iTunes.